You're listening to Pastor Talk. Welcome to Pastor Talk, the podcast of Lifeway Pastors, giving you the tools and encouragement you need to shepherd your flock well. I'm your host, Marty Duren.
It is a laboratory, and I mean, and I think it's really, it's important if you're going to write books to have done some hard work and practice of writing before you get to that point. I think that's important. And it, a lot of people think, oh, I want to be a writer. So they immediately expect to sort of be at a certain level in writing. But it just takes a lot of time.
That's Trevin Wax. Trevin is the author of Counterfeit Gospels and This Is Our Time, among other books. He's also the proprietor of the Kingdom People blog at trevinwax.com.
Writing to publish also can create writer's block, where you feel like you have to arrive at a finished product. So if you're simply writing for the sake of a blog post, you can write total garbage, mm-hmm. and you never have to publish it. But there's a sense of sort of working it out of your system. Like, sometimes you have to do crummy work to get to the good work or to figure out what you think. I mean, the number of unfinished drafts I have on my computer is just countless. It's like two paragraphs here and four here, and sometimes it's 1,000 words, and then I look at it and go, that's just slop.
That's Barnabas Piper. Barnabas is the author of The Pastor's Kid, Help My Unbelief, and The Curious Christian, just released. Barnabas also blogs periodically.
For me, the reason I even started writing in eighth grade, or, you know, I was journaling stuff before that, but the reason I started writing kind of publicly was I was doing, you know, devotional stuff or reading some Christian book or just, you know, scripture. And I said, I'm journaling this stuff privately to kind of work through it and think through it. Why don't I try to do that online so I can, you know, in my better days, help people, in my worst days, impress people.
That's Chris Martin. Chris is the editor of millennialevangelical.com and is a rising voice on evangelical millennials and the church. Welcome to Pastor Talk. This is a special edition. It's a Pastor Talk roundtable. In the studio with me today are three awesome writers: Trevin Wax, Barnabas Piper, and Chris Martin. And I'm really glad they could be here today. Each one of them is an author of some sort or another and a writer in some capacity. So I'm going to let them do a really brief personal bio, and then we'll get on into the subject at hand, which is writing. That seems to be a subject of interest to pastors. Pastors like to write and publish books and all that kind of good stuff. Now, if you're looking for tips on how to do a better newsletter, this is probably not going to be the podcast for you. But if you're interested in books and blogs and stuff, then you might get some tips and tricks. So, Chris Martin, tell us a little bit about your Taylor University graduating self. Oh, and Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary, master of something or another.
Congratulations,
yeah,
Chris.
Right. Yeah, thanks. I just graduated from Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary with my MDiv, and it was a great time there.
Master of Divinity. Awesome.
I'm going to pretend like I understand that reference. I just graduated from there. I've been blogging for a long time, since I was like in middle school, which is sad to say, but I was writing online back then. Blog now, millennialevangelical.com, and have a book on the subject coming out soon, with Rainer Publishing. So I'm awesome. Perhaps the least experienced writer here, but I have a little bit of experience.
You've been blogging a lot longer than I have.
That's true. Yeah, since like 2005.
Yep, I didn't start for about 5 years after
I started in 2004.
Yeah.
Barnabas Piper.
Yes, I am. I work here at Lifeway. I'm the marketing manager for B&H Academic and Word Search Bible. And as a writer, I'm an occasional blogger and online writer, contributor to different websites, and the author of three books: The Pastor's Kid, Help My Unbelief, and The Curious Christian, which just came out earlier this year with B&H. And Marty and I had a conversation about that one on an earlier podcast.
We did. That is in the early years, the early formative stages
right.
of Pastor Talk, you still hold the most listened to spot.
Yes!
You know, I haven't been on to talk about This Is Our Time yet. So, were you planning, is that invitation in the...
We hit a nerve.
Do you have a book?
They came out the same day as Barnabas.
Oh, I'm sorry. It was overshadowed. Oh, that's the real issue that's going on here. Yeah.
One of us tweets more than the other about their own books.
Apparently, it wasn't your time.
Yeah.
Trevin Wax.
Yep. So I am Bible and Reference Publisher at Lifeway. That means I oversee the Bibles and commentaries that we produce and the launch of the Christian Standard Bible, the CSB. I also have I've served as editor of the Gospel Project curriculum. Been writing for a long time. I remember I first writing something of my own was in first grade. So I've been at this for a while.
Was it published in the Washington Post or New York Times?
No.
School newsletter?
Highlights. Highlights.
Yeah, I remember
just
that.
Kidding. Just no, not really.
Wait,
it was not.
Wait a minute. Were you published in Highlights?
No, I was not.
Okay.
I would have given that one a round of applause. That would have been impressive.
Yeah.
Read and more. Trevin Wax has been read in more pediatricians' offices than anybody in the history of the world.
That's right.
And dentists.
Okay. So I started blogging in 2006. At the end of 2006, so I've been blogging regularly for a while, and also contribute to different places online. Christianity Today, World, Washington Post, Religion News Service for a while, although I've kind of backed off on that because I'm teaching pastor at my church now, so some things had to give for me to be able to.
Okay, does anybody feel like they need a redo so that you can put some more cred in?
I feel like I need to say what I do at Lifeway. I didn't realize.
Oh, okay, go ahead.
So I am an author development specialist.
So you do something at Lifeway?
Yeah, I do. Well,
that's awesome.
Theoretically.
You don't blog from your mom's basement.
No.
Just to clarify.
You're not a real millennial.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So I help authors, about 15 authors right now, with their social media and blogs online. So,
okay, cool.
Yeah, so I kind of help them do
Trevin's
these
latest
guys.
Book might need some help.
True.
It got overshadowed by Barnabas.
He can't schedule podcast appointments to save his life.
I've got other podcasts, just not this one.
I'm
a little
shocked.
I think
I actually tried to get you on here.
Okay, so I didn't finish telling books.
Because you said I was too cynical.
I did not. I said, Marty and I are like the opposite kinds of people. I tend to lean on the naive side, and he tends to lean on the cynical side. He put us together, we'd probably be pretty wise. Anyway. What? Does that not like public knowledge?
I'm just waiting for you to introduce your
books. Oh, okay. No, the books. Okay. This Is Our Time, most recent. Before that, Gospel Center Teaching, Counterfeit Gospels, Clear Winter Nights. Which Marty's going to mock. My foray into fiction didn't go so well. I'm going to stick with This Is Our Time. It was never our time for fiction from Trevin, I don't think.
Oh, man.
I appreciate authors who take risks, like writing fiction, because that sounds terrifying.
I'd love to write fiction sometimes.
It was terrifying. It was terrifying.
I've read your books, Barnabas. You're pretty good at fiction.
Thank you.
Oh.
fake news.
Okay, this is a roundtable, and this is actually the first one that we've done for Pastor Talk. It won't be the last, but the subject of writing is interesting to a lot of pastors. I get asked, and I'm sure you guys get asked, about publishing, whether it's self-publishing, or how can I get a publishing deal, or how can I publish my sermons, or just how can I be a better writer for my blog. Or there's lots of different venues. And this is really unscripted, so this is like freestyle edition. Trevin's going to do some breakdancing during the breaks.
We'll Facebook Live that.
But we will start off with just a really basic question. Why do you write?
For me, writing has always kind of been the second half of the thinking process. So, you know, some people are verbal processors. Some people are like internal. I don't know what all the official categories are. Like my wife, I know she's a verbal processor. So a lot of times when she's working through a problem, whether it be, you know, at work or personally or whatever, she likes to have a conversation about it. For me, the reason I even started writing in eighth grade, or, you know, I was journaling stuff before that, but the reason I started writing kind of publicly was I was doing, you know, devotional stuff or reading some Christian book or just, you know, scripture. And I said, I'm journaling this stuff privately to kind of work through it and think through it. Why don't I try to do that online so I can, you know, in my better days, help people, in my worst days, impress people, right?
And in your really worst days, get criticized by a ton of people.
Well, not when I was in eighth grade. Oh, okay. but yes, on really bad days today, especially.
But I bet we can dig those posts up.
They still exist, and I'm not sharing the link. Good luck finding it. But yeah, so it's always been kind of, still today, is like if there's a subject I really am thinking about or reading about a lot and I want to process that further, I'll write it out. And that may end up being public. It may not.
That sounds like therapy.
Yeah, really. I mean, that's kind of...
cheaper than a psychiatrist.
Yeah, exactly. It's not always, you know, deep and emotional and, you know, hard issues.
That's what journals are for.
Yeah.
They're the therapy.
Exactly. The private stuff that doesn't get published.
Wasn't Zanga like a journal?
Yeah. Well, I was on Zanga, yeah. And then I was on LiveJournal, which is, I mean, literally...
Yeah,
that's
a journal.
That's where the first blog still is.
So
self-indulgent blogging.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Trevin, why do you write?
Yeah, this is a question I've had to think about for a while lately because...
Yeah, I asked it like 3 minutes ago.
No, well, I've actually asked myself that question before you asked it. Believe it or not.
I do believe it.
For me,
I've read some stuff I've written and asked, why do I write?
And I've read responses to some of the stuff I've written, and my wife has asked, why do you write? For me, therapy, you just said writing kind of is therapy. For me, it's been more thinking. It goes back to what Chris says. This is the way I think things through. And I like to put my thoughts down in a way that I know will resonate with other people. And they'll be like, one of the best things that anyone ever says to me is, you said what I was thinking, but in a way I wouldn't have known how to say mm-hmm. that.
Yep.
I love that. But connecting this to pastors, because this is pastor talk though, we as pastors communicate with words. So whether you do a full sermon manuscript or not, you are thinking about the words you're going to share with your congregation. And so this is part of what we do. We read, we study scripture, study commentaries, books, whatnot, put this all together, tell stories. We when we're preaching, we are giving words to our people. So whether or not we actually consider ourselves writers, we are communicators. Some of us may also write to help bolster whatever it is we're doing pastorally, but all of us as pastors are called to be communicators. Some pastors may also want to back that up with putting some of those thoughts from sermons and things down into writing. And I mean, you said no talk about newsletters, but that is one place you can do that.
Right.
You know, you can actually have different touch points for your congregation to some of the truths that you want to share.
I would just say
if you
have a monthly column in your church newsletter or something, then get better. Do it well.
That's a great little laboratory to test that stuff out.
And send it to people who will give you honest feedback and not just, oh, this is wonderful. You know, like,
right.
That's why you never send me your books in advance, right? You're not looking for
honest feedback.
Not cynical feedback.
Barnabas, why do you write?
The short answer is because I like to. I think in the writing sort of sphere, you know, writing is a thing that a lot of people are clued into. I see a lot of sort of navel gazing, you know, oh, it's so difficult, it's so challenging. And I'm like, just quit. If you hate it so much, don't write. I love writing. I think it's fun. I think it's enjoyable. It as a craft and as a process, it definitely is challenging, especially if you're trying to complete a project or publish a book or hit a deadline. Mm-hmm. But the overarching act of writing and the completion of a thought process and the communication aspect, I just enjoy it. And I think the other aspect is I think God has given people the ability to communicate in different ways. Some people are exceptionally good conversationalists. Some people are exceptionally good orators or speakers. And some people have the gift of putting ideas down in writing better than they do in other ways. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of those things that over time I've gotten comfortable with the idea that I can do that. And I hope that doesn't come across as arrogant. But I think if you write and publish, you better have some confidence that you're doing a good job of it. So I think that's a thing that I think God has given me and the three of you as well, the ability to do. And so to not do it is to not use a gift, an ability that God has given me and you respectively also.
Yeah, I think like when I'm talking with authors about, you know, these often, most of the time, I'm working with authors who have already been published in print, in books or Bible studies or whatever, and they will question the necessity to do a blog or social media sometimes. And I come at it from a stewardship perspective. Like, the Lord has clearly given you the ability and gift of writing. Mm-hmm. You've done that in books and Bible studies already. I think you have a sort of responsibility to steward that gift online. Your audience is online. They want to read you. They're on Facebook, Twitter. They're reading other blogs and getting spiritual insight in whatever sphere you're in from other people. I think you have this sort of responsibility in the same way that you have this stewardship to take the gift God has given you to serve the church mm-hmm. in print. I think that should extend online as well. And that's why I think blogs are so important for people who are published in print as well.
Blogs are great places to start out,
start
out ideas, know, to throw out things to...
laboratory.
It is a laboratory. And I mean, and I think it's really, it's important if you're going to write books to have done some hard work and practice of writing before you get to that point. I think that's important. And it a lot of people think, oh, I want to be a writer. So they immediately expect to sort of be at a certain level in writing. But it just takes a lot of time. It's like is it Malcolm Gladwell with a 10,000-hour rule, you know, before you're an expert in anything?
Well, he stole it from somebody else or borrowed it, but he made it famous.
Yeah. Well, he wrote about it well.
Yeah.
That's why we're talking about him.
And he's a good writer who has done a lot of that lab work in articles and New Yorker columns and then multiple books now.
Yeah, that's true, because he didn't just start off with The Tipping Point.
No, he was a journalist for a long time before he was a best-selling author.
Right. We did I don't know what we called this, a book club. Boy, that sounds really bad, but we did two books.
But Gone Girl was so good.
Yeah, that's right.
I like The Fault in Our Stars the best, personally.
Clear winter nights, buddy. All night long. We have, so we read two books together as a group. We read William Zinsser's book on writing well, which is a classic. And then after we read that, which is a book about the craft of writing, and it goes into a lot of details about all the different types of writing, not just writing. Then we read together Michael Herr's book, I think, Dispatches, which we had to get Trevin's mom to sign a permission slip.
they use naughty language.
They use naughty language. Zinsser's book, I think, is, I mean, it's probably middle school okay for reading. I don't remember any stuff. If you pick up a copy of Dispatches, which we read to read good writing, Herr was a war correspondent in Vietnam, and so this is a collection of columns and pieces that he wrote for Rolling Stone and others. I can't even remember who all now, maybe Vanity Fair.
Mm-hmm.
So it's war language and war description, so it's not something you're going to study with your small group.
It's what Christians like to call gritty.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
And then there is, quote, some content.
Yeah, there is.
But the imagery is, I mean, if you want, look for writing, I mean, some of the images from that book stick in my mind right now just because of how they were described.
Yeah, it's roundly
brutal.
Considered the best, if not the best, one of the best war correspondent, war description type books that has been penned to date. But when we were in that group for those two, going through those two books, what are some of the things that you pulled out of Zinsser or pulled out of Herr? Am I saying his name? It's Herr, H-E-R-R, right?
Yeah, I don't know how you say it, but that's how you spell it.
I would call it, that's how I pronounce it.
I was afraid it was K-E-R-R, but it's H-E-R-R. No. What are some of the things that stuck out? And I know you guys are all fans of Stephen King's book On Writing, which I've read as well and is good. The thing that sticks with me about from King's is the thing about adverbs. The road to hell is paved with adverbs. I cannot get that out of my mind, and I have numerous times gone through things.
Is it adverbs or adjectives?
Adverbs.
Adverbs. You just look up the L-Y's and you're finding. I mean, I've literally done this.
Use the verb that conveys the thought you're trying to convey by using the adverb.
Go back through your document, look up the L-Y's, and then find them all, and then decide,
He rails against dialogue descriptors, too. Like, right after that section, because I'm reading it right now, he's like, never say, you know, Bill said exuberantly or said excitedly.
Bill said.
Yeah, just say Bill said.
Okay,
yeah.
But I will say, J.K. Rowling.
Trevin said.
She breaks that rule and somehow it works for her. She breaks that rule all the time in Harry Potter.
And Stephen King,
I think that's part of the reason is that she's not looking for clean prose. She's looking to essentially take you on a roller coaster ride. Like, those books are sort of a rollicking ride of a story. And so lots of description, especially for kids,
helps. She's painting the world.
Yeah. It's just splashes of color.
And Stephen King himself said, I'm an ordinary sinner like anybody else. He said, you can go through my works of fiction and find this stuff all over the place. Mm-hmm. But he said, he describes it as being an ordinary sinner like anybody else. So he sees a problem with it, but he's like, I'm not exempt.
I think the thing, one of the things from Zinsser's that stands out to me now, how this applies to pastors, I'm not exactly sure, but when he talked about interviewing people for stories and how to ask questions and just that whole section, what did he write? He wrote about going to write a story on like a bird expert and something he didn't know anything about and just sort of letting the questions discover themselves and letting the person tell their story. And so rather than going in with an agenda, sort of just letting the person tell the story and then you finding it in their answers. I thought that whole section was really, really helpful because interviewing is hard and writing a story about a person you've interviewed, representing them well is really difficult as well.
There's a practice that Stephen King described that's similar to that, where his theory is that the story develops as you write.
Mm-hmm.
So I did an exercise one time where I asked friends of mine to give me the opening sentence to a short story. Hmm. So I would take their opening sentence and then I would just start writing something that had to do with that sentence and see how long I could write where just the story was coming out at the same time that I was writing it down. So I didn't outline anything. I didn't have an end in mind. And these are all short stories. They're a page, page and a half. It was really short stuff. But it was an interesting exercise because a lot of people think, I don't have anything to write about. You really do have something to write about. And if you want to write a story and you don't know how to start, ask your wife, ask your husband, ask your friend, give me one sentence that can start a story. And no matter how weird it might be, write it down and then write something after it and write something after it. And you will learn how to take the thoughts that come in, get them onto paper. Don't worry about editing. You're just getting ideas down. So I wound up with a story about an airplane, a story about, you know, a car wreck, a story about birth, a story about
clear winter nights,
a story about clear winter nights, grandpa's, nightgown. I had all these different things that I was able to write about. I mean, none of this is Pulitzer material for sure, but it was an exercise that got me to writing.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the things you do? Not writer's block, but when you sit down and you think, I need to do the X, but it's just not there.
I think, before they answer that question, because I'm not sure what my answer to that question would be, I think that's how C.S. Lewis started Narnia, is he had the image of a fawn by a lamppost in the woods.
Okay.
With some partials. And that was the beginning for the entire seven books, was just that image.
Man,
was what he had in his mind.
Just ruined my next series.
Yeah.
that was the image that was in my mind.
Just swap it out for like a Minotaur, you'll be fine.
That's true.
But writer's block happens when you're, in my experience anyway, writer's block happens when you're afraid of your reader.
Okay, elaborate.
When you're second guessing yourself, when you're worried about what is someone going to think about what I'm putting down on the page, you look at the blank page and it's just, and you're also.
Instead of trying to write your thoughts, you're trying to write their thoughts,
yes.
Almost.
And the other thing is that gives you writer's block is you see that blank page and you freak out about the beginning. Mm-hmm. You're like, I don't know how to start this. Okay, well then don't start it.
Yep.
Why don't you just jump in with with an idea anywhere, mm-hmm. not necessarily what your beginning is going to be, and write that. And then go back and figure out the best way to introduce what you want to say. Yep. First write what you want to say and then go back and figure out the start. But so being afraid of the reader, just being hypercritical on yourself first when nobody's even going to see what you're writing right then. It's a draft. And then being freaked out at the beginning is common. And I'm sure there are some other things.
Writing to publish also can create writer's block where you feel like you have to arrive at a finished product. So if you're simply writing for the sake of a blog post, you can write total garbage, mm-hmm. and you never have to publish it. But there's a sense of sort of working it out of your system. Like sometimes you have to do crummy work to get to the good work or to figure out what you think. I mean, the number of unfinished drafts I have on my computer is just countless. It's like two paragraphs here and four here. And sometimes it's 1,000 words. And then I look at it and go, that's just slop. It's terrible. That's never going to see the light of day. I keep it because there's always that vain hope that I might go back and revisit it. But I know I should just throw it away. I also think writer's block is often just a product of fatigue. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the best thing to do is go read a book, watch a show, take a walk, take a nap, grab a snack. Like, give yourself permission to not write stuff until you gain a little bit of mental energy and can kind of push through a little bit.
Yeah, if you have writer's block, like if you're sitting down, and this is going to depend on context, but like if you're sitting down and you're like, I don't know what to write. Well, the reason if you're sitting on the couch watching Netflix, you don't just randomly have writer's block. You only have writer's block when you are wanting or trying to write,
mm-hmm.
right? So when I have that problem, I ask myself, well, why am I even trying to write in the first place? So is it I have writer's block about a school paper, or I have writer's block about this sermon or lecture I'm trying to prep, or do I have writer's block about this blog post, and I'm just like sitting down because I typically post on Tuesdays and Thursdays and need to get something up for Thursday? Mm-hmm. Well, then you ask your question, well, why are you trying to write? Well, I'm trying to help my audience, or I'm trying to teach these people or preach this scripture. Okay, well then, what are the primary needs of my audience? That's one of the questions I'm always asking myself if I have a little bit of freedom. You know, if it's not set for me, hey, you need to preach this text, then you have your prompt. You know, I rarely have writer's block when someone gives me a prompt like that, because it's like, well, I don't have any big decisions
to make.
Chris,
we want you to preach on the Lord is our shepherd from Psalm 23.
Okay,
Can you pull it off, right?
So
frozen,
right? Oh no, what do I do? Well, you start and look at the text, but if you know, I'm just trying to prep a blog post, or someone asked me to write an article for another site. Okay, who's going to be reading this? What are their needs? How can I address those needs? Those are kind of the questions I'm asking myself when I'm trying to like push through.
They're service questions.
Yeah.
Which are really more a lot better than like platform questions.
Exactly.
Like, you know, how can I get the most people in the world to read this? Yeah, or how can I do, I mean.
Yeah, I mean, there are ways. And
you won't believe how.
But BuzzFeed has figured that out.
Well, and look.
That doesn't make
you a
thought
leader. In defense of the listicle, okay, which is a blog post that's like five ways or six steps or whatever, there are ways to package your writing in formats that are easier to consume. I don't think there's anything wrong
sometimes
with that.
Sometimes they're easier to write, too.
Exactly.
It's hard to write a 1,000-word narrative about something, but it might be easy to write 200-word paragraphs.
Exactly.
That's right.
And so in defense of the listicle, you know, it doesn't always have to be cheap. You're going to probably have three headers in a typical blog post or whatever anyway, so why not give it that number and help people read it? I think, it's a service to the reader.
For online content, listicles can be consumed in so many different, the elevator, the carpool. I mean, it's just an easier way that you refer back to it in an easier fashion.
Yeah.
I could give a word of caution on the audience-centric thought process.
No, you cannot.
I think, especially for pastors, that's a really important thing because you ought to be serving a congregation.
Sure.
You know, a readership. However, there is a risk of positioning yourself as an expert and talking down to readers when you see this in Christian books. So I've been in Christian publishing now for about 9 or 10 years, have read a ton of Christian books. It's a world I'm probably overly immersed in. And a huge number of those books are from people who essentially are treating their readers as dumb.
Yeah,
is what it comes across like. Instead of writing a book that you think they would actually want to read,
do you mean by dumbing down the content or by talking down condescendingly, or both?
Preachers preach like this too. Sometimes the best preachers are preaching a sermon that they would want to sit in the pew and listen to. That their heart needs.
Yeah.
And the best writers are writing something that they would want to click on the link and read or open up the book and read. And so when thinking of your readers, think of them with the respect that they are due, not of yourself as the content expert on this stuff.
I think that's a really good point.
I've used this imagery when talking about like pastors and stuff too, and I know some people would probably disagree with it, but like I think of a blogger or an author or something like that, not as a shepherd leading sheep, like that's the wrong mindset,
right?
But as just the lead sheep, right? So not as the coach so much as like the player coach, kind of coming alongside and saying like...
It's like the captain of the team instead of the coach of the team.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's the mindset I have more of, like going together, like not... See, and it's more of, you never really say things like that, but it's just more of like
Welcome readers to the captain's call.
It's the first person voice, the first person plural. It's we, not you.
Exactly. Yeah. That's the perspective.
But one of the reasons you may sense that in Christian publishing is that the pastor does have that shepherd and sheep role.
Of course. So a
certain way that they may talk with their own congregation where there's an established relationship and love and affection and they're trusting him to give them, you know, good solid food may not translate into a book that goes out to all of evangelicalism, if they're using that same kind of that same kind of tone, where they're not the shepherd of
using social media as well.
For sure.
What are the challenges in? We all blog to some degree. Y'all are much more consistent at it than I am. What is the challenge about coming up with relevance? Probably a horrible word. But staying current, let's just say it that way. What's the challenge with staying current? Because when I do occasionally blog, my desire is usually to either clarify something that's in the news, try to find out if there are facts that are not in play or bad facts. Barnabas hashtag fake news me a few minutes ago. you know, is there a fake news story that I can address in some way? that helps people have a better idea of what's going on? Is there an angle, a biblical angle that's not being addressed by Trevin or Barnabas or another writer that I can find a niche in the same story or the same narrative that's being talked about? How do you decide how you're going to address a given subject matter in that very public world of the blog?
This is a hard question. You first started by asking how do you stay current,
right.
I'm not. Well, answer either one of them. I'm not sure that I think of what I do blog wise as trying to stay current, because I know some of my blog posts are timeless in the sense that I can link them back out in a year or two, and they're going to be just.
Did you say some of your blog posts are timeless?
I mean, timeless in like they're not evergreen. Timely. They're evergreen.
Evergreen.
Sorry. Yeah, not.
They're good in
they
TV
are literary so. Classics, is what you meant.
Yeah. They're going to be in leather bound volumes.
Kafka esque.
Yeah. What I mean, like you've got your timeless and timely, or evergreen and timely, whatever. But a lot of times you're just doing something that's going to still be applicable at another time. Other times, though, you do step into a space where you feel like there's nobody speaking to this, and it may be that I could say something that hasn't been said. Like you said, you're looking for that. Has anyone else said this? Because if someone else has said it and said it about the way you would say it, or at least made the point, then just link to their post.
Share their stuff.
Like, you know, give them.
That's like one of the Christian blogosphere's biggest weaknesses is everybody has the same take or a take on the same thing.
And
they're just sort of gradients of the same color. And you're like, just share whoever wrote it first and wrote it well. And then write something
else. If you want to add a little comment, do it on Twitter or whatever, you know. But that's.
Start a conversation.
Yeah. So definitely pay attention to what other people have said. I think that's important.
Yes.
But figure out, be really intentional if you're going to go, if you're going to speak to something. I mean, I recently, Karina and I watched an entire Netflix show, basically begrudgingly walked through a show because I had a personal experience that was to this show. I'd had several people ask me about it. Mm-hmm. No one at my sort of my blog neighborhood at Gospel Coalition had addressed it. And so I was like, you know, I feel that I need to write about this. And so that was a really intentional current event kind of a thing that I decided. But I think you got to be intentional about that.
The first question you asked, like biggest obstacles to doing it, I think just practically the biggest obstacle to doing it is like making the time. Mm-hmm. Writing timeless stuff, you can sit down on a Saturday and bang out 5 blog posts, you know. And
who
like,
can?
Well, I mean,
Chris Martin.
Oh, okay.
I mean, but I know
you
what you
about
mean.
Someone
yeah.
who can. Trevin can.
Okay. You and Neil Postman.
But,
buddy.
he's one of my favorite people now. So, yeah, but I mean, like, timeless stuff you can do whenever you want. Timeless stuff, like, I remember one of the best examples of this is back when I was working for Ed Stetzer when he was here, and I would occasionally.
Name drop.
Yeah.
I would occasionally write stuff for the blog at Christianity Today. And when the Planned Parenthood videos came out, what was that, like 2 summers ago?
Mm-hmm.
There was one that came out, you know, late at night one night, and we wanted to post about it on the blog. And I sat down at my desk in my home office at like 10 o'clock at night and wrote this blog post because I really wanted to have one of the first takes on it. Because I just happened to be, you know, working on schoolwork and saw it come across Twitter, and I was like, oh, I want to post this and talk about this. So I wrote a blog post at CT or whatever about this Planned Parenthood thing at 10 o'clock at night. Mm-hmm. Most people can't do that. You know, I was 24 and have no kids and was just working on schoolwork. A pastor who wants to have a current event kind of oriented blog most likely can't do that. Most people with lives can't do that. So writing timely content requires you to be available to write when a timely writable event comes along.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and if it comes along and you're not available, you skip that one, you do another one. Yeah, exactly. That's honestly how it goes.
Especially for pastors. If you're in a situation, so like the role you were in was part of a team that addressed current events. It was sort of a cultural commentary kind of thing that was a specific role. But for pastors and for most writers, having the first take and having the hot take are not, like, you just need to have the right take. So if you need to sit on something for 3 or 4 or 5 days to read what else is being written, to see, I mean, that's the way I write almost nothing in a timely fashion, you know, in response to an event, because it's just, part of it's not the way I'm wired, and part of it is because I don't trust my own take right off the bat. My knee-jerk reaction is usually my worst reaction.
Yeah.
Whereas if I can read 3 or 4 or 5 other posts from different perspectives, if I can see what the conservative evangelical take on this is and what are the holes in it, what are they not addressing, what are the blind spots, then later I can hopefully say something that's more beneficial, even if it's not going to get as many clicks, because the news cycle has already tipped to go on to something else.
Yeah, I can't tell you how many posts I've not published for that very reason. By the time there was time to think through it, to come up with the take that I thought needed to be addressed, the story was old. I mean, it was gone. Nobody was going to read it.
But did
my
you
mother.
Think differently about it by that point? Because sometimes you do change.
I would have written the same thing. The story had, it was gone. It was no longer, nobody's talking
about
it anymore.
It would have been way late.
Something else had come up.
Yeah.
So the time issue, which we won't have a lot of time to address, is an issue. Trevin is probably the fastest writer of content that I've ever seen. I'm one of the slowest writers. Even when I was doing a blog post a day, it took forever for me to do research, to proofread, to edit myself, to get images and all that kind of thing. I'd be sitting on the couch or sitting at the kitchen table while my wife was preparing dinner or whatever, and for 2 hours I'm writing something, and hopefully it's right, and then hopefully remember to ask her to proofread it so it's not got 10 spelling errors in it or whatever. Time is a real factor if you're going to write, whether it's a blog post 3 times a week or whether it's a book. If you're not willing to put time into it, how do you do that? You went away. One of your books, you went away for 3 days. I'm looking at Trevin. Sorry, folks. You went away for 3 days and stayed in somebody's cabin and wrote a book, didn't you?
I did 2 books that way, but I did This Is Our Time. I went away for kind of a 4-day weekend and no family with me and just wrote basically 12, 14 hours a day. I mean, I was not doing any editing. Mm-hmm. I spent months after that corralling that, sculpting that. But it's kind of like, if you look at it like a sculpture, you get all the clay and everything together, and it's all the ingredients are there, and then you come back later and you actually make something of it. So it would, you know, when people say they go away a weekend to write a book, it's like, well, kind of.
It's like answering how long does it take to write a book. Well, usually you've been chewing on the idea for 3 years before you put a word on a page, and then you take notes for who knows how long.
Yeah, you gather materials.
You know, and then to sit down and, like, when does the writing process start? I don't know.
Somewhere
along the way?
I'm writing my first book right now, and I've been writing on millennials and in the church and religious issues for almost three years. It'll be 3 years this month, it is. And I just started the book in December, and I finished it in, 4 months. But that's while doing my last semester of seminary, but that's after 3 months of handling this data, and I already had a lot of the, you know, stats together and stories and general outline together, and then I just had to sit down kind of like Trevin described and just, you know, every Saturday morning for 3-4 months spend a few hours banging it out.
And I think that's, if you want time for writing, that's what you do. I mean, it doesn't have to be every Saturday morning, but I mean, 2-3 times a week at least for a block of time. And it could be 2 hours in the evenings. It could be waking up earlier and 2 hours in the morning. It could be 8 to 12 on Saturday mornings, but just you block the time and you go use it.
Yeah.
And so I encourage writers not to worry about word count or production as much as filling up the time that they have blocked.
Right.
Because that way, if you worry about word counts, if you have a rough writing day, you feel like a failure.
Or you try to stretch it and end up writing something terrible that you just have to go back and fix later.
Whereas if you,
I don't know what that's like.
You just got out of school and you know all about that, Chris.
Yeah.
But if you use your time well, then you still did a productive thing, even if you wrote 200 crummy words over that 2-hour period and you throw them away. That's okay. That was well-used time, because the next two-hour period, you might knock out 2 800-word blog posts that you feel really good about and because of the previous, grind that you did. So I'd say consistent time used well, and
I
don't
agree.
Worry about production in quite as much.
One note,
Chris
I wanted
is
to
raising
get,
his hand.
One note I wanted to get in. Just we've moved away from this topic a little bit, but we were talking about pastors and having blogs and current event stuff. This is a personal kind of conviction when I've talked to pastors about blogging. And so, if you're listening and you want to blog, take it or leave it. I tend to think, especially as a pastor, you're kind of using church time to work on a blog. Your blog should first be a ministry to the people in your church.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're going to write a take on a current event or something like that, I don't think pastors should be blogging to get famous. I don't think anybody should be blogging to get famous. But I don't think pastors should be blogging.
That's exactly what I was about to say.
I don't think pastors should be blogging for a global ministry first. If that's what it turns into, praise the Lord. But I think pastors...
Or if that's what your church leadership, like, team has said, we want you to be invested in this.
Exactly.
But I think... If after a week your posts have, like, 3 Facebook shares, you're not having any global impact.
Right. Mm-hmm. I think...
But even if that's the case, that doesn't mean the pastor's work...
No, I'm saying if that's the goal.
Oh, if that's the goal, yeah. I was just about to say, I really appreciate pastors who write for their congregations.
Oh, exactly. Absolutely.
My point is like, you know, if you're a pastor sitting today and you're like, maybe I should start a blog. First think... How can this blog be a ministry to the people of my church? Especially if you're sitting at your desk on a Tuesday morning and using time you should be like doing ministry stuff.
Right.
And not, you know, on a Saturday afternoon when you're typically
watching
football.
And I would also say that it's possible if you have a larger desire to write of other things, then most church websites have the capacity to have a pastor's blog.
Yeah.
Write your pastoral stuff there. If you have a desire to write sports or something else, do that on your personal blog somewhere.
Yeah,
somewhere
right, there. Exactly, for your local paper or something
And be prepared for somebody in your congregation to not like it.
Yeah, you're opening... I mean, it's another form of communication. You're opening yourself up to comments like just like you get after a sermon or whatever.
Oh, boy.
Except they're on the internet, which means they will be worse. Read.
They'll be worse, right.
Because they can hide behind an anonymous name and say mean things.
Or if on Facebook, nowadays on Facebook, people are not, they're so brazen anymore. They're like, I don't even care.
Yeah.
I don't even care.
It's bizarre. Yeah. Okay, so it's easier to publish a book than ever before because you can go to Amazon and go right into their publishing system, publish a Kindle book, literally for nothing except the time that it takes you to upload to produce the content and upload the content. You can get a print book published through Amazon's system for very little, if anything. But most people, when they're thinking of publishing a book, aren't thinking about that specifically. They're thinking about the traditional way of you send a manuscript to whoever or 50 whoevers, and you try to get a contract or something like that. So let's talk a little bit about the technical side. All of you are involved in publishing. Two of you have published books with actual publishers. I've only ever published books with not-so-actual publishers.
Chris is in process with a publisher.
Yes. So what's different? What's difficult? Let's just say it that way. What is difficult about getting published with a traditional known publisher, whether Christian or fiction or non-Christian or whatever? What's difficult these days about it?
I think a couple things come to mind. The complaint that you will hear from a lot of aspiring writers is that publishers look at platform more than content. That's a whole separate debate about that, about the business model of that.
So explain that just a little.
Right. So if you send in a book proposal, if you don't know what a book proposal is, go Google it, start there, and get your basics down, because you can't get published without a book proposal. Yeah.
If you don't know what a book proposal is, that's one of the reasons you haven't published a book
right.
yet.
Right. So you send your book proposal in with some sample writing, and they say something along the lines of, and I know this because I have said this to authors before.
And it's been said to me before.
You know, love the concept, your writing is strong, you just don't have the platform, which usually consists of...
Speaking opportunities, Twitter followers, Facebook followers,
podcasts, you know, what any voice that puts you out into the world, it's your brand.
So they want you to be somebody before they publish a book.
Right. And then, you know, then it's a chicken or the egg, because how do you become somebody without getting the backing of a publisher or something like that? It's also dangerous because it gets people in the position of chasing platform, which I think generally isn't a helpful thing. I think another thing, having been on the acquisition side, so on the publisher side, most proposed books or most authors proposing a book don't realize, they're just not aware of the marketplace. Mm-hmm. They look around and they're like, I have this amazing book on marriage. Mm-hmm. Like, you know what? I see 44 of these a month.
Right.
From people that are better well-known and more have more expertise on this than you do.
Yeah.
And probably been married a lot longer.
And then the third... yeah, that's right. The third thing
for my first anniversary, I'd like to publish a book on marriage.
That's right. The third thing is you need to be an accurate self-evaluator. There's a lot of people who try to write books who just are not... They're just not good writers.
Right.
And so you need to have either some friends... who know books, who will tell you this needs to be sharpened up, or you just need to be in tune enough with what is good writing to be able to say, I'm not sure I'm there yet. Because most publishers will not tell you if your writing is not good enough because they don't want to hurt your feelings. They'll find another reason, but what they really are saying is that's just not good enough.
So you're saying, just to back up a little bit, you're saying that even publishers won't always say your writing is not good enough to publish.
No, not often because especially a Christian publisher, there's a sense of like we don't want to be right. mean. So you need to have a blunt friend who's just like, I don't think that's good enough to publish.
So I want to clarify, because what we tend to do when we write something is send it to the people that we know the best, that are our biggest fans. So we send it to our spouse, our parents, our friends, and they typically give us the feedback that we want to get, which is, oh, this is awesome. People be crazy not to publish this.
Your mom's been telling you were a superstar since you were four, so she's not going to tell you your book stinks.
Yeah. Trevin, you got any thoughts on that?
Well, some moms might, but...
those are different relationships.
No, I agree with everything that they've said there. I mean, I think that it is harder to get into publishing these days, and it's frustrating because you think good quality work is going to stand on its own. Well, sometimes it does, but... It generally does begin with a bigger picture of the market, who's reading, what audience are you serving, do you have credibility with that audience? I mean, all of those things have to go into the mind of the publisher. And so I've been on both sides of that, being on the publisher side and on the author side. And there were different challenges the other way too. So I think it's part of it is in the next generation, we're going to have to kind of figure out what that looks like. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I agree with Barnabas though, chasing platform in order to get a book deal is going to be counterproductive if you're not actually becoming the kind of person and growing in your experience to be the kind of person that is going to write the good book that you had the idea for in the first place.
It's a mercenary pursuit, and those never pay off in a ministry context.
I have a lot of thoughts about this, but two brief ones. My job, in part, is to help authors, I guess, in the terms of our context, build their platform. I don't like to think of it that way because it has such a negative connotation. I think it's a pretty neutral practice. It's not wholly positive or negative, but I think I agree with everything they said, that chasing a platform is not a good way to do it. It not only is it going to be bad for like your soul, and like you're probably sinning chasing pride in that, but also it's just not an effective way to build a platform. Mm-hmm. Now, the most effective way to build a platform is to do it in a sort of inconspicuous way that is as least self-promotional as you can be, at least until you have a book to promote. You know, if you just build a platform trying to make yourself look important or tell people how great your ideas are, it's just going to be bad. So I think if you... building a platform is most effectively done as an act of service. And I think you'll be better off for that, and the Lord will bless that. Also, second thought on this, the whole platform thing, reading the Stephen King book on writing, he's talking in the first part about when he had been rejected by some fiction, like short story publications. Mm-hmm. And there were a couple short stories he submitted that were rejected. And then his first major book, Carrie, mm-hmm. was accepted and was like a nationwide, worldwide bestseller.
Right.
And then he later found those manuscripts from the short stories that had been rejected. I think he said sent them in unedited from when he had first sent them in, and they were like instantly accepted.
Right.
So it's not like this whole, you know, being known is an important factor is a new thing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's right.
It's just it's become more
new means and methods.
And everybody is expected to be known now because everybody has the means to be known now in a way that they haven't before.
Well, thanks for joining this Pastor Talk Roundtable. My guests today have been Chris Martin, whom you can follow at ChrisMartin17. He apparently could not buy at Chris Martin from that Coldplay guy.
Yeah.
I'm loath to let Barnabas have a nod to his Twitter account because he's so down on platform, but you can follow Barnabas Piper at Barnabas Piper.
Barnabas doesn't chase followers, though.
You'll never see a promoted tweet from Barnabas Piper.
I hope not.
And then at Trevin Wax, that's right.
T-R-E-V-I-N
Wax.
He did manage to buy that off of the more famous Trevin Wax.
That is true. I'd forgotten that story.
You did with a Barnabas Piper.
Right.
Totally
yep.
made up. And then you can follow me at Marty Duran. Also check out at Lifeway Pastors and LifewayPastors.com. Thanks for listening to Pastor Talk. If you have any questions about any of this, feel free to tweet these guys, and they'll do what they can to steer you in the right direction. Until next time, thanks a lot.
Pastor Talk is the podcast of Lifeway Pastors and is hosted by Marty Duran. That's me.
Join us each week as I interview pastors, authors, professors, and others to help your ministry as you seek to shepherd your flock well. Until next time, this is Marty Dunn.